This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Jetzt gibt's Cheez-It, ein neuer knuspriger Snack, der köstlich nach Käse schmeckt. Hol dir jetzt deine Packung im Handel und das Beste, du kannst sie einmal gratis testen. Wer will heute Abend den Cheez-It? Cheez-It, der Cheez-It. Jetzt zum Gratis-Testen. Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Kauf- und Kassenbon-Upload bis 30. Juni erforderlich. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht. Teilnahmebedingungen auf Aktionspackungen und auf cheezit-aktion.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the intellectual panic room where, buffeted by claims and counterclaims, you and I can quietly and calmly get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, how much has the pandemic damaged relations between China and the West? In the pandemic world, a new Cold War seems to be in danger of breaking out between China and the West. Tensions between the US and China had been growing before the coronavirus outbreak, but have deteriorated in the last few months. And it's not just the US. This week, Australia called for an independent global inquiry into the origins and spread of COVID-19, a call which was met by a Chinese imposition of swingeing tariffs and selective bans on Australian imports. Here on the BBC, Matthias Döpfner, chief executive of German technology company Axel Springer, said that Europe now needed to choose which side it was on.
Dealing with China, showing a bit more self-confidence, is overdue. And I think Europe now has to make a decision, including the post-Brexit UK, whether we want to establish the transatlantic alliance of free market economies or an alternative alliance with China. So I think for Europe, it's absolutely high time to decide.
So how much damage has the pandemic done to relations between China and the West? And what's the outlook once it's over? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with the view from the US. Professor Neil Ferguson is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Neil Ferguson, what is the US view of China's handling of the pandemic and how's that view evolved?
Well, I'm always careful about saying there is a US view on anything. Remember, we are deeply divided in this country on all issues. But I think the broad view is that China bungled and then covered up its bungling of the initial outbreak in Wuhan, that China denied that there was human-to-human transmission long after Chinese doctors had recognized that there was, and that when China imposed its lockdown on Hubei province, it was too late because by the 23rd of January, millions of people had already left Wuhan, not just for the rest of China, but for the rest of the world, including the United States, which had direct flights from Wuhan to John F. Kennedy and San Francisco Airport. So I think that's not really controversial. Added to which, of course, China has engaged in systematic disinformation to try to deny that the virus originated in China and to spread fake news to the effect that somehow it came to China from a US military team competing in Wuhan in October. And I think there's a great deal of indignation at this kind of Russian-style campaign to spread fake news on the internet, particularly when it's directly involved Chinese diplomats.
Do we have a rough idea over what period of time that shift of opinion has taken place?
Opinion towards China was relatively friendly, if one goes back just a couple of years. But in the very recent past, there's been a big shift. The Pew polling organization has some extremely interesting data on this question. So if you go back to where we were before Trump took over in the White House, you had a kind of 47-44 split on American views of China, 47% unfavorable, 44% favorable. Fast forward to 2020, and it is 66% unfavorable, 26% favorable. And this shift in sentiment on China is really a crucial thing for Trump because he really did lead the shift. When Trump launched his election campaign in 2015 and included the threat of tariffs on China, this was what a lot of American voters had been waiting for a long time. The sense that China had been taking manufacturing jobs away from Americans was very widespread amongst ordinary people, but nobody had really articulated it for years. I wrote at the beginning of last year that Cold War II had begun between the United States and this time the People's Republic of China. And it wasn't just about tariffs. It was about technology, including not just 5G networks, but a whole range of issues, artificial intelligence, even quantum computing. And the relationship, which used to be so close that I coined the word Chimerica, the relationship has broken down. And if anything, what the pandemic has done has been to reveal that.
So why have we moved from Chimerica to Cold War II?
The answer is that the benefits of Chimerica disproportionately went to China. Secondly, the hopes that a generation of US policymakers, going back all the way to Henry Kissinger, had that bringing China into the international community would lead to liberalization have been dashed. Thirdly, I think under Xi, China's become so much more overtly competitive with the United States in geopolitical terms, but a bunch of other stuff too. When the Chinese were moving up the value chain from apparel, you know, shoes and clothes, to, I don't know, the very most sophisticated semiconductors that give it a capacity to match the US and even beat it in domains like artificial intelligence. For all these reasons, the US-China relationship was bound to deteriorate. There was bound to be conflict between a rising power and an incumbent established power.
To what extent is it felt in the US that the administration is partially attacking China to deflect from what seems to be bound to be a fairly negative analysis of their own handling of the crisis?
I think it's clear that Republicans are really worried about the way in which things are going. It's not just the perception that Trump has not handled the pandemic well. It's more a sense that the economy is in a very deep hole, in a depression, potentially. So I think fear of a kind of voter shift is driving the campaign on the Republican side to find some point of contact with voters. And I said earlier in our conversation that the United States was deeply polarized and that people disagreed about almost every issue. Maybe on China, there's just that one point of consensus. It's not just Republicans who think that there's a problem. Democrats think this too. And from the vantage point of Joe Biden, the presumptive nominee for the presidential election, it's very awkward for him that he seemed soft on China early on in his campaign. Trump is bound to accuse Biden of being soft on China, and Biden is bound to have to prove otherwise by taking a tougher line. So it might well be that anti-Chinese sentiment is just one of the very few things Americans can agree about these days.
That was Neil Ferguson, who was speaking to me from a cabin in Montana. What about attitudes towards China in countries elsewhere in the world? The Briefing Room's Rosamund Jones spoke to Raffaello Pantucci, director of the Institute of Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute.
Let's go back to sort of pre-pandemic times. The US aside, what sort of relationship did other countries have with China? Could you start off by telling me a bit about the EU?
The EU had a position on China that was shifting, and it was shifting increasingly in a sort of American direction. We'd seen some major strategic documents coming out of the European Union where they'd identified China as a sort of strategic competitor. And there's a real sense that, you know, China was increasingly a power that needed to have some sort of greater confrontation.
And what about African nations?
African nations have had a sort of historically complicated relationship with China because on the one hand, you know, China's always held itself up as a sort of great standard bearer for the kind of developing world. But over time, that sort of narrative took a slightly different twist as we started to see people worry about Chinese economic colonialism. The perception was that you had sort of large Chinese economic actors that were coming in that were building projects where this sort of debt burden was being carried by the state. An unknown amount of money was sort of disappearing into somebody's pockets. Infrastructure was maybe showing up, but it was never quite the quality that was expected. There was a sense that it was coming into Africa to take advantage of the countries.
Before the pandemic hit, what sort of relationship had the UK been developing with China?
the UK's policy on China had been quite scattered in many ways. Essentially, each different government department was advancing its own policy. On the one hand, you had, you know, the Ministry of Defense, who were listening to their American counterparts. Whereas on the other hand, you had, you know, departments like DFID that were saying, well, actually, China's investing very heavily in parts of the third world where we're trying to, you know, alleviate poverty.
Now, how's the pandemic changed attitudes to China? Tell me firstly a bit about what's going on in Australia.
The debate in Australia around China has become very strong, with a general sense that, you know, China needs to be resisted and thrown out of every sort of possible opportunity and confronted in every way. Very much a sort of even more extreme articulation in some ways of what you see, say, in Washington. Australia is ultimately an Asian power. And so within Australia's backyard, it has watched as China has gone from being, you know, a developing power to being this sort of behemoth that is slowly surrounding Australia. And it sees this as, you know, the push of a communist one-party state that is advancing norms that very much clash with Australian democracy.
Tell me a little bit about Russia.
I mean, Sino-Russian relationships are fascinating because on the one hand, you've got a partnership there, which is, you know, at a geopolitical level, very much in lockstep. Two countries led by, you know, authoritarian regimes who, you know, rule with a fairly iron fist their countries. And they see the world is, you know, in the middle of a conflict between themselves, the sort of one-party strongmen, and Western democracies who are trying to spread democracy around the world. And they see this in the color revolutions that swept through the former Soviet Union in the sort of 2000s, and then later in the Arab Spring in 2011. And from Russian China's perspective, they see this sort of pattern of revolutions happening as a set of dominoes in some ways that ultimately will lead potentially with regime change happening in Moscow and Beijing. And that sort of reality ties the two of them together against the West. However, having said that, you can see all sorts of tensions exacerbated as a result of COVID-19. For example, bus drivers being told to report any Chinese people they saw on their buses. And this sort of fed to a very basic kind of yellow peril fear, which is this sense that we're sitting next to this giant economic beast that is just across our border, which is just going to kind of sweep in and take over sort of the empty Russian East.
And to what extent has China, perhaps seeing a worsening of relations since the pandemic, been on some sort of diplomatic initiative?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen two big messages coming out of China and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. On the one hand is medical diplomacy. And this is, you know, articulating itself in sending of PPE equipment all around the world, in sending Chinese doctors to help others.
And what's been the response to those initiatives?
The two broad narratives is on the one hand, people saying, you know, thank you. And on the other hand, a sense of anger because it turns out that some of this equipment is actually faulty. And I think which of those narratives is more dominant really depends on the kind of narrative within that country around China more generally. But on the other hand, there's also been an interesting narrative that you've seen push, which says that, you know, China is not responsible for this. And China is, in fact, angry that everyone is pointing all these fingers at it. You know, the sort of big buzzword around the pandemic and geopolitics is acceleration. Everything has been accelerated and speeded up that was happening before. You know, China's rise and how people were concerned about it, and also China feeling much more assertive on the world stage is all coming to the fore. And who knows where the world ends up going. And I think that is, you know, a source of enormous concern all over the world.
Raffaello Pantucci. Now, critically, I want to try and understand the view from inside China. What do its people make of the shifts in world opinion? Dr. Yu Jie is Senior Research Fellow on China at Chatham House. Take us back to the early weeks of the pandemic in China. What do we know about how the Chinese people viewed their government's handling of the crisis?
Because this epidemic situation was worsening, and the Wuhan local government had a tendency of covering up. So the Chinese population getting extremely angry about it, how the provincial government handled the delay. So the turning point come to the time of 8th of February, after the death of Dr. Li Wenliang. He was considered as the whistleblower, tried to tell everybody that there was some kind of strange pneumonia across the city. And then he was told, do not spread rumors, by the local police. And then the doctor himself caught the COVID-19 and sadly passed away on the 7th of February. And after the provincial governor Hubei has been dismissed by the central government, by Xi Jinping, and therefore take a much heavy-handed approach to dealt with the epidemic.
Now, how has opinion evolved since the government, as you put it, came in with a heavy hand and seemed to sort things out?
China managed to turn its corner, stop the first wave, because the government has offered effective way of control the disease. So that was a narrative has been told and retold again inside China.
Do the Chinese people believe what the government tells them about the death statistics?
There are some questions around that. It's such a large country with 34 different provinces. Nobody can know exactly that the Chinese government already adjusts the figure. So it's a way of telling its people, look, we address the issue, but for the real truth and how many people exactly passed away because of COVID-19, nobody really knows.
So has the Chinese government faced any further criticism since then?
One of the major complaints towards the central government is why the central government was not able to hand face masks to every single member of each household inside China. Even though Xi Jinping perhaps is the most powerful president we ever had in China, he's not free from examination and scrutiny from its own population.
One of the things that puzzles me, and I think would puzzle quite a lot of listeners, is here you have an incredibly strong regime that is able to boast of incredible economic growth and benefits to its population. And yet it behaves as if it's permanently terrified of criticism or something going wrong. How are we to square that circle?
I often joke this with my foreign friends that China nowadays is shaped by two Germans. The first German is obviously Karl Marx, who was the founding father of communism. But on the other hand, China is also shaped by another German, Karl Lagerfeld, who is the Chanel designer, and that really tailored the Chinese middle class to have such a luxury taste. So it's a country that worshipping both equality and inequality.
And so the government is frightened that the tensions will build up in society that will drive it apart.
The tension will build up on the society, and the tension will also build up on young people, furious young people, once they couldn't find a job, and they will turn their anger towards the government.
Are the Chinese people actually aware of how the rest of the world sees China as being responsible for the pandemic and how that might be increasing anti-Chinese sentiment?
The Chinese people believe that certain politicians in the West are trying to divert attention away from their own mishandling back to their domestic situation. And it is not about older Chinese generation. It was actually, surprisingly, it's the younger generation who strongly believe that Western government performed really horribly in this pandemic. And those young people are able to read English, are able to read Financial Times and Economist almost on a daily basis, and they believe that narrative. As soon as the Western liberal democracy began to talk about how China behaved so badly in this pandemic, the Chinese population will naturally gravitate towards its own government by saying, look, we are the one who have turned the corner, not United States and not United Kingdom.
Do you think that the consequence of the pandemic has been to make the Chinese people more nationalistic?
I would use the word of more patriotic.
Dr. Yu Jie. That's the view from outside and the view from inside China. Now I'd like to know, as a result of this, how the world's relationship with China might change. Let's look at that in two parts, taking the economy first. Dr. Linda Yu is an author and economist. Linda, over the past couple of decades, can you remind us how important China has been in fueling global growth?
Very important. Over the last couple of decades, it's overtaken the United States and become the world's biggest exporter and importer. If you think about, for instance, companies like Apple, they have been selling more iPhones in China than in the United States or any other market. And I would also say an important way in which countries have looked to China is because of its role as the world's biggest manufacturer. But this pandemic, I think, has highlighted supply chains as something that can be disrupted and have huge consequences. And this ranges not just from consumer goods, but also to things like pharmaceutical ingredients, of which China produces a significant portion, which is imported by the United States and other countries. Because of that, and a backlash against China in terms of COVID-19, I think there is a re-examination of supply chains.
Now, I recall a period not so very long ago when British governments, Conservative governments, were incredibly keen on talking about the opportunities of trade with China. And it was actually regarded as almost a primary focus of UK effort. Is it your impression that in the more recent past, the UK has been rethinking that attitude?
So there's been some tension over the Chinese company Huawei in providing 5G capability to the UK. And the tension comes from the United States as well as other countries, which are concerned about a Chinese company providing strategic telecoms. So the American government is against having Huawei provide this to the UK and to other countries. And the dilemma for the British government is, how do you balance these foreign intelligence and security concerns expressed by a longtime ally, the United States, with this commercial openness to trade and investment? And so this is an example of the kind of tension the British and other governments will be facing. And I expect more of these tensions to come in the future.
If the West does start in any kind of big way to try and wean itself economically off a kind of dependence on China, what kind of effect would that have on the Chinese economy?
One of the challenges for the Chinese economy is that if there is a backlash against it, then it's still a middle-income country. So average incomes in China are about $10,000 per year. So a country at that stage of development needs to be able to tap into global markets and needs to continue to catch up. And this is why this backlash against China would potentially have implications for China's medium-term development goals. And this also explains why over the past few years, China has increasingly promoted its own indigenous innovation in a plan called the Made in China 2025 plan, where they want 70% of all inputs into high-tech sectors, industries, to be Chinese-made. Part of that is your natural evolution of a country. When you become middle class, you naturally rely more on your own consumers and your own firms to be innovators. But this has been accelerated by global tensions. And I think this is a pattern we're going to continue to see.
What you seem to be suggesting is that there's this kind of movement away from the idea of the benefits of global trade for the world's economies.
We're coming into a period where you are going to look at a lot more of how do you help the losers from globalization and how can countries integrate their foreign policies with their trade and investment policies, you know, in a more consistent way.
Dr. Linda Yu, painting a picture of trends and dilemmas in world trade. But beyond economics, what sort of world order do we seem to be heading towards? Professor Steve Tsang is director of the SOAS China Institute. There's this developing double narrative in the US that China has had a huge role in causing this pandemic, and the alternative view in China that the West's handling of the pandemic is to blame for the depth of the international crisis. How do you think this is going to play out?
In China, I would say that it is playing out quite well for the Communist Party, with the Western democracies showing that they are not coping well.
But as we develop this two-way blame game that seems to be intensifying, where does it lead?
In terms of relationship between China and the rest of the world, I think it is backfiring. Very few people in the Western democracies believe that the virus did not originate in China. And the very aggressive way the Chinese government is arguing that the virus started outside of China does not have credibility. And therefore, in terms of how they respond to relationship with China, I think we are going to see some significant review of policy. But whether that will result in actual change in policy, I think remains to be seen.
One of the things I remember people discussing in the past was how careful Chinese foreign policy was, that it was not based on confrontation, that it was based, in a sense, on taking a relatively soft approach. And now you have this much more belligerent approach. Do you sense there are any debates within the Chinese Communist Party at all about the dangers of such belligerence?
There are people within the Communist Party who are uncomfortable. A lot of them feel that it is much too early for China to take that very aggressive approach. But Xi Jinping has taken a very different view even before COVID-19. And we are seeing that in terms of what is now called the Wolf Warrior diplomacy. Wolf Warrior is based on a recent Chinese movie, which is a kind of Chinese version of Rambo, who goes all over the world taking down evil Americans. And this is being seen as China asserting itself, rightfully demanding its place under the sun. All through the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, the Communist Party had put more emphasis on managing propaganda than it has on the economic fallout or the public health angle. And therefore, Chinese diplomats and others engaging with the outside world knows that their first audience is not their host country, but Xi Jinping.
But what about their perception of the damage this can cause? I mean, saying, for example, we don't need Australian products, it obviously leads the Australians and anybody else to say, well, if you don't need our products, then we don't need yours.
That may well be so, but letting down China in terms of protecting the dignity and the image of the Chinese people is much more important in terms of career advancement terms.
What do you understand of the calculation of the Chinese government in this? Do they think that we will reach a point where everybody says, oh, we've had enough of this bad talking? Or aren't they worried that actually this is a ratchet that just continuously escalates?
In terms of the relationship with the United States, I think the Chinese government quite rightly calculate that the Americans will do what the Americans will do anyway, whatever the Chinese say or do.
What do you think the United Kingdom will do? The problem for the UK is exemplified really in the Huawei business, which is we're worried about the security implications on the one hand and the pressure from America. And on the other hand, there's the economic power of China and the degree to which our economies are already to a certain extent intertwined. How do we resolve that?
I would expect that at the end of the COVID-19 crisis, there will be a review of China policy. But whether that will result in a change in policy, I think, is a very different matter. We have to bear in mind that the United Kingdom have been substantially diminished in terms of its economic capacity and economic resilience. Also, with the effect of us getting out of the EU, will allow the government to have the capacity to take risk in terms of relationship with China. I would not count on it.
So you think we may well just put the economy first?
That will probably be the priority.
Professor Steve Tsang. This is a gigantic subject and hard to summarise, but it seems fair to suggest that the easy bit of globalism may be over. What comes next will require real leadership and intelligence. My thanks to Neil Ferguson, Raffaella Pantucci, Yu Jie, Linda Yu and Steve Tsang. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Sally Abrahams and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on the economic and psychological impacts of the pandemic, as well as easing the lockdown and the inequalities of lockdown. Also, the care sector and COVID and coronavirus, from testing to vaccine. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Jetzt gibt's Cheez-It. Ein neuer knuspriger Snack, der köstlich nach Käse schmeckt. Hol dir jetzt deine Packung im Handel und das Beste, du kannst sie einmal gratis testen. Wer will heute Abend den Cheez-It? Cheez-It, der Cheez-It. Jetzt zum Gratis-Testen. Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Kauf- und Kassenbon-Upload bis 30. Juni erforderlich. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht. Teilnahmebedingungen auf Aktionspackungen und auf cheez-it-aktion.de.